entire to the educated world, maybe because of Herodotus or maybe because of other reasons, that was absorbed into our tradition.
So it was a myth rather than an actuality.
So it was a myth rather
than an actuality.
So let's now get out of the Jewish tradition and see whether this is a myth or an actuality at all. And here, the story is again extremely amusing, because as we saw, the Encyclopedia Britannica in the 11th edition says it's an entirely a myth, and the Encyclopedia Britannica in the 1965 edition says that this is certainly a reality. So that therefore, we're forced to come to grips with this question as to the who's telling the truth here. And the answer seems to be that this whole subject has been dominated from the beginning to the end by political or ideological considerations. The fact that Voltaire and Beaumarchais and people of that ilk in the 18th century used this as a crowbar with which to attack the clergy and with which to attack the feudal system, I think that's pretty clear. In the 19th century, there was, as I say, a revolt against this.
So there must have been something happening in France at that time. I mean, if they attacked this.
French Revolution.
No, they said that look how terrible the feudal system is because this was part of the feudal law. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was part of the feudal law. It's just because they're referring to some events that have occurred to 200 or 300 centuries before their time. The people in the 19th century then started to review the evidence, and began to see that there was really no basis in the documents that these people had as to whether such an event occurred. But at the time that the historians were beginning to say that this was sheer invention, and that was ultimately this particular book by Schmidt, whose review relative to Jewish sources, the one that we discussed, another group of people came on the scene, and these were the anthropologists. The anthropologists were motivated by some global theory of human evolution. And many of them, or most of them, took the position that the natural state of man is one of promiscuity. Marriage is a late development in the human condition, and that the natural and the primitive state of man was one of promiscuity, and therefore, having a man, just the natural state of human society is one of communism, one shouldn't own private property, one shouldn't have private women, and that when there was a devolution from this natural state to the state of private property, at the transition point, this was regarded as a crime against the community. I mean, this is complete nonsense. You understand that this was the position of the classical anthropologists
around when?
In the middle of the 19th century and towards the end of the 19th century. A summary of that position is in, let me see, I should have, here. Let's take a look in the article here, Ternana. This is from the Spanish Encyclopedia.
Okay. What was Spanish?
Yeah. So if we take a look, let's just read the beginning paragraphs there and you just get a feel for this. All right, do you all have this? Okay. Ternana, History and Sociology. Right? Do you have the page? Yeah, okay. Many of the sociologists, do we have this? Muchos de sus religios. I mean, maybe some people here in Spanish may be better than mine, but if there's no volunteer, I will translate from the Spanish to the English. Many of the sociologists affiliated to the philosophical, the Spencer School of Philosophy, or the Evolutionary School of Philosophy, have extended Do you have it, Dr. Schwab?
That's all right.
Towards the end.
I shall finish fishing if you guys would like me.
Spanish is second language, huh?
You brought it into your school, you all speak Spanish.
It's not Spanish, it's not the right terminology, now it's Latino.
What you do?
So let's just read this. Many of the sociologists affiliated with the philosophical Spencer School of Philosophy, or the evolutionary school of philosophy, have extended the domain to the domain of sociology the fundamental principles of their doctrine, and have affirmed that just as in the domain of pure speculation, progress characterizes itself by steps from indefinite states and chaotic states and heterogeneous states that others more determined homogeneous. Similarly, in the domain of sociology, evolution progressively realizes itself in the feeling of concretization of rights and less instances of abuse and a greatly reduced numbers of persons. For example, of communal or collective property becomes private. Polygamy or polyandry passes to monogamy, and so on. And these steps along the path are recognized by a whole series of events which indicate in an indubitable manner the nature of these various limits. Going from this hypothesis of a primitive state of promiscuity, some sociologists are of the opinion that the path towards monogamy and the formation of paternal power was not so easy. And it took place in a society completely impregnated by ideas so materialistic, such that the women were from steps of the originally matriarchal society things of the same category as weapons, for example, which belonged to all of the men of the familial group, and therefore they progressively that from came into a private appropriation of a wife. And various rights had to be employed in order to, of a more or less sensual character, and which are foreign to our fundamental moral ideas, in order to mediate these changes, and so on. So I'm giving you a rough translation. But the idea here was that that these sociologists took the opinion that these rights of the king or the ruler of the society to the first nights of the first night with the brides was an expiation, a society's expiation against the crime of private marriage displacing a communal general property rights. So this was the sort of the position in of many of these anthropologists towards the end of the 19th century. And then when you had people who sort of felt that maybe the natural state of man was one of marriage and monogamy rather than as polygamy, since the existence of these facts had already been completely imprinted on their mind, they gave an entirely different interpretation to this supposed event. And for example, I brought here a whole chapter in a book by a famous anthropologist by the name of Westermark, in which he shows that, where is it? It's called the History of Human Marriage, right? The hypothesis of promiscuity
or communal marriage is supposed to derive much support from certain customs which are interpreted as acts of expiation for individual marriage. You have that?
Yeah.
Okay. In many cases, we are told that the exclusive possession of a wife can only be legally acquired by temporary recognition of the pre-existing communal rights. As a recognition of this kind, is regarded the jus primae noctis according to a priest, king, chief, or nobleman, who is then looked upon as a representative of the community after the ancient right is taken away from its male members in general. Among some of the Brazilian Indians, the jus primae noctis is said to be granted to the medicine man or to the chief. And then he goes through a whole list of various different anthropological positions in which the jus primae noctis is taking place in all of these different societies. But of course, this contradicts his position, which is that the promiscuity was not the original state of man, and monogamy is not a crime. Apparently, this is a reaction to that position taken by the anthropologist. So his interpretation is quite different. His interpretation is that there was a taboo against having relations with a virgin, or that this was a difficult medical procedure, and therefore the medicine man or the high priest or whoever have you was performing a service to the for the groom in undertaking to have the first relations with the bride. Again, having nothing to do with oppression, but simply a form of medical service provided.
Managed care,
right.
Who's the man?
This was Westermarck. Is the author of this. It's called a History of Marriage. So, to summarize the situation, I think that the subject of whether this did or did not exist is something, I mean, we want to say that, you know, people's prior opinions determine their assessment of historical facts, but I think this is one of the things that was carried to the ultimate extreme. The situation, it seems to me, is the following, and I think I brought a reasonably good summary of the entire thinking on the situation in the last article that I've appended here, which is called What the Seigneur, Fact or Fantasy, in which he points out, as I said, that the historians deny that this has existed, the anthropologists of one school or another have established that this must have existed because of their prior attitudes on the question, and you take your point. I mean, I don't know of any other situation in which the where the position is so extreme. Namely, you have one school of people saying that this is obviously true, and another school of people saying that this is obviously false. I tend to go along if I can read the evidence second or third or fourth hand with the historical school, which says that this was some story that was repeated from what the tribe over the hill was doing or some other group of people were doing, and which has little or no basis in fact. And therefore, I think we come to an interesting conclusion, which is that in our sources as well, I think we have to assume that, for example, on the Medrash that we saw, the last source that we had, which was the B'nei Elohim and B'nei Sa'adam, where one is really seeing the influence of Herodotus, that is somehow or other the general culture which was telling the story got interpreted and attached to this particular passage in the Chumash, and that this as a form of oppression was also sort of incorporated at a late stage. The first time that we saw it was in the Gemara and Rabba, which was talking 200 or 300 years after whatever events he was attempting to describe, and that it gives us a little bit of a lesson to be a little wary of general types of tales or stories, because
the rapist occurs at the very end of the first
celebration.
Just before the flood.
Just before the flood. One of the causes.
Now, I thought that's to explain the giants, right?
Yeah. No, no, but they are saying that what their crime was, that when they would get the brides ready for their husbands, the rulers would come and take it away.
Well, has anything like this turned up in, let's say, remote South Sudan?
Sure, you can read. You have many, many cases, both in Spanish and in English, of these cases occurring all over the place. The last book that I've seen on the subject is this one, which was written relatively recently, which reviews the evidence and comes to the conclusion that certainly in Europe this never existed, and if it ever existed in any of these other societies, it's a reflection of some entirely different effect, but certainly not one of oppression. So I think that's more or less where we'll stop on this strange subject.
Rebbe, one time you mentioned that when he was a young fellow, and you read somewhere in the Gemara about the marriage between two men. You
know? Mm-hmm.
And now,
that was a Gemara in
the
Chumash.
It makes sense now because what's going on.
Well, there is a situation where my refusal to believe something just indicated that what you're talking about is the Gemara in Chulin, which says, in defense of the Romans, that at least they never had any marriage contracts between two men. And as I said, when I learned that Gemara, which was 40 or 45 years ago, I thought that this was an exaggeration. How could you ever have a society in which they would even be proposed the notion that a homosexual marriage would be legalized? And you see how wrong I was, because this is now something.
Did they have it then, or what didn't they have it?
The Gemara says that they didn't have
it.
But when I learned the tenor,
the story was preposterous.
I thought that the story was so preposterous that this was sort of a malign attack.
So you think we're just reinventing the wheel in the 20s?
No, just goes to show that one should never assess some other sociological system from the basis of your own private judgment.
Yeah, exactly.
But here, in this particular case, I'm willing to accept the idea that there are certain societies whose attitude towards marriage and towards sex and towards everything else is completely different from ours, and I'm not in a position to judge whether Westermark, who brings all of these cases from the South Sea Islands or the Brazilians of one type or thing or another is telling the truth or not. I'm not going out to the field to investigate it. But within the framework of the domain where the historians seem to have actual access to legal texts and so on, I think there's no trace of this. And that, therefore, the stories that are reported either in the Gemara, in the Babli, and in the Yerushalmi, and in the Medrash, and in the Medrash Rabbah, I think are reflections of some circulating stories that were taking place, but not necessarily of true events.
And that used different part of darkness or something.
Right.
You may, right?
No. I'm simply saying that that it gives us a little bit of pause as to how to deal with questions that are imported into our culture from ambient and surrounding culture. Whether the question itself is of interest, I don't know. I mean, you know, this. What I find interesting about it is that you can have an issue which presumably should be a historical question that is so dominated by ideology that you can't really come to any frank conclusion. Okay, so that's what I really wanted to say tonight. As I say, my main service here is just spending many, many, many hours in the library trying to come to some conclusion and Xeroxing this material for you, and then you can read it at your own leisure. It seems to be silly for me to continue reading in English then.